Someone emailed me my opening story. A young lady named Sally related an experience she had in a seminary class given by her teacher that we'll call Brother Smith. She said he was known for his elaborate object lessons. One particular day, Sally walked into seminary and knew they were in for another fun day. On the wall was a big target, and on a nearby table were a number of darts, a whole pile of darts. The teacher told the students to draw a picture of someone whom they disliked or someone who made them angry, and he would let them throw darts at the person's picture. Sally's girlfriend on her right drew a picture of a girl who had stolen her boyfriend. Another friend on her left drew a picture of his little brother. Sally drew a picture of the teacher himself, putting a great deal of detail into her drawing, even putting pimples on his face. She was really pleased with the overall effect she had achieved. The class lined up and began throwing darts with a lot of laughter and hilarity. Some of the students threw their darts with such force that the targets were ripping apart. Sally looked forward to her turn and was filled with disappointment when the teacher, because of time limits, asked the students to return to their seats. As Sally sat thinking about how angry she was because she didn't have a chance to throw any darts at her target, the teacher began removing the target from the wall, and everyone saw something underneath. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25, we read, "Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another." Read verse 26 with me, would you please? 26 and 27 together. "Be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil." I want to speak to you this morning on the subject, how to help a person with his anger, or how to deal with anger in someone else. As with every human problem and emotion, the Bible has a great deal to say about the problem of anger, many, many verses. I counted the number of times that the word anger, angry, wrath, wroth, fury, furious, and indignation occurred in the Bible, and it was 584 times. And yet perhaps the pivotal verse, maybe the key verse of all of those verses, may be this one that says, "Be ye angry and sin not, let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil." The Greek verb tense on this word, "be angry and sin not," that little phrase right there, that Greek verb tense is the most significant to me of any that I have ever found anywhere in all of the Scriptures. It is, and you have to listen very carefully to get this, but it is very, very significant. Incidentally, just a few months ago, I talked to two different nationally known Greek scholars and confirmed what I'm about to share with you with them. It is a present passive imperative. Present means that it is something currently taking place. Passive means not that you are acting, but that you are being acted upon. Imperative is a command. And the meaning is this: be ye angered and sin not. It means there are going to be times when you feel something or someone working on you to make you angry. Recognize that. Don't let it happen. Be ye angered, but don't sin by getting angry. And then also, you will give place or ground to the devil. What is the number one thing that causes anger to start to rise in you or me? Anger in someone else. I had someone ask me the question, "Is there any way for a son or daughter in a home to help a father with a problem with anger?" I'll tell you what I told them later in the message. But the key thing is not how to deal this morning with your anger. I've preached on that in other messages. The key topic this morning is how to help someone else deal with their anger. It is too easy for us to get so caught up with someone else's actions that we forget the importance of our reactions. God isn't going to judge me for someone else's actions. He's going to judge me for my reactions and the actions that come from them. The most dangerous situation is not a hot head and a cold head. The most dangerous situation is two hot heads. It makes a lot of sense if you just think about it. You have one person with a temper of 150 degrees and another person with a temper of 50 degrees. You've only got a total of 200 degrees. But if you got two people with a temper of 150 degrees, you put them together, you got 300 degrees, and you're over the boiling point now. Not many, probably not any of us here tonight or this morning who have not had to deal with an angry person. Maybe even a husband or a wife or a son or a daughter. It may be in public. It may be at a flower shop. It may be at a traffic light. You maybe absent-mindedly let your foot get too loose on the brake and you run into the man in front of you, you hit his rear bumper, and suddenly you're dealing with all kinds of anger. Maybe when you're right and the other person is wrong is when you have to deal with his anger. Christians are often in the greatest danger not when they're wrong, but when they're right. When you're right and you're having to deal with somebody who's wrong, it is much easier to become bitter. That's the reason that Jesus told us to go the second mile. That's the reason that He told us to turn the other cheek. So how can you help a person with his anger? Number one, understand that there are probably some things you don't understand. Understand that there are probably some things you don't understand. Understand that there might be some misunderstanding on your part. Anger towards you may not really be because of you. It may be a spin-off because of other things. It is very easy for somebody, especially for men and women who go to work and they deal with problems on the job and then come home and they're all tensed up and they're upset and they take that out on their mate or on their children. It is easy for anger to be a spinoff. Somebody illustrated it like this. When Marty got mad and let loose his temper on his best friend, it'd be good if his best friend knew some things. That a fellow employee had crossed over into his territory and taken some of his most important clients. That the boss told him he was going to lose his job if his work didn't improve. That Marty is way in debt because of his daughter's prolonged illness. That Marty has been working two jobs just trying to make ends meet. And that overall, though it is very important for each of us to feel like our life is accomplishing something, Marty is feeling like a terrible failure. Now, you see, if you stop and think those thoughts, that doesn't justify Marty's anger, but it shows you what is happening. It helps if you understand that there are things you may not understand. Sometimes anger is an emotional cry for help. One of the greatest preachers of the 20th century is Dr. Jack Hiles. He tells how he went into a restaurant one day and the waitress was very curt and rude toward him. And he tried to cheer her up and she just wouldn't cheer up. And he tried to say each time she came around, she was just curt and rude. And it just happened every time she came around to his table. When they got done with the meal, he left a $50 tip on the table. And when he was paying for his meal at the cash register, she came running up to him and said, "Sir, why did you accidentally left this money on the table?" He said, "No, ma'am, don't you tip here." She said, "Well, yes, but..." She started to cry. She said, "After I was so rude to you." He said, "Ma'am, I've lived long enough. I can see when someone is hurting. And I knew you just had to be hurting today. And so I just thought I would try to help your hurt a little bit. She began to weep and cry and tell all the problems she was having with her husband and her children. And he stood there and won her to Jesus Christ. Because he understood there were probably some things he didn't understand. One writer said that 80 to 90% of anger is probably displaced anger. The boss yells at the employee. The employee goes home and yells at his wife. The wife yells at the child. The child kicks the dog and the dog chases the cat. And it just keeps going on down. So understand there are probably things you don't understand. Number two, deal properly with your own anger. You want to help somebody else? You can't help somebody else with anger if you've got the problem yourself. But you're probably not going to be able to. How are you going to deal properly with your own anger? Well, you're going to have to, first of all, acknowledge that it is indeed sin. We have played as a people, as Christians, in the last several decades, we have played around with anger and tried to defend it and tried to say it's all right and won't really recognize that the Bible is clear that it is sin. Psalm 37:8 says, "Cease from anger and forsake wrath." The verse does not say, "Keep spiritual anger, forsake carnal anger." It says, "Cease from anger and forsake wrath." Proverbs 19:19 says, "A man of great wrath shall suffer punishment. If thou deliver him, yet thou must do it again." Proverbs 27:4 says, "Wrath is cruel, and anger is outrageous." Outrageous means like a downpour or a flood. It is not possible to have a little bit of anger. Anger is a flood. Ecclesiastes 7:9 says, "Anger rests in the bosom of fools." Galatians 5:19 and 20, "Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these." Listen to the works of the flesh. Adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath. Wrath is right in there with adultery, idolatry, and witchcraft. I've said this before in another message. You don't bring X-rated movies into your house and watch them as a family. You just don't do that. You don't bring an idol into your living room and bow down before it. You just don't do that. You don't have a witch come into your house and hold a seance. You just don't do that. And you don't get angry at your house. They tie together. They're tied together by God. Adultery, idolatry, witchcraft, and wrath. Ephesians 4:31 says, "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger be put away from you." So you deal with your own anger the proper way by acknowledging that it is sin, confessing it to God, asking God to forgive you. Of course, if you've never really trusted Jesus Christ as Savior, that's the place for anybody to start, by acknowledging to God that you're a lost sinner on your way to hell and asking Jesus to come into your heart, forgive you of your sins, and be your Savior. That's number one for anybody and everybody. That's the most important thing. You can forget everything else I say this morning. If you've never been saved, then don't leave this service this morning without acknowledging to God you're a sinner and asking Christ to save you. And then, secondly, in dealing properly with your own anger, control your anger God's way instead of the world's way. I've read articles by both secular psychologists and Christian counselors who say that you must release anger. Incidentally, it's interesting that they're starting to recant that now. Since the anger has become so widespread, I read another article just recently that was talking about what we've said all these years is not right, that you've got to release anger. Well, what is happening is, as these people are releasing anger now, we're finding out it is devastating. It's devastating not only to others, it's devastating to them. I read an article recently that talked about how anger messes up your heart vessels. Even if you're expressing it at a pillow, by beating the pillow and beating it and beating it and beating it, or maybe taking a picture of a person you're mad at, walking into a room and screaming and fussing at that person, or using a dartboard, throwing darts at that person. Anytime you're expressing anger, you are not just, even if that person is not present, you are doing something to damage your own physical well-being. Of course, another problem with that reasoning is that it doesn't take into account that anger is not really something you can properly control. It usually gets out of control. It's like a skunk spraying a little bit under your house. It tends not to be a little bit. It is a flood that washes away homes and lives and churches. Trying to have a little bit of anger is like trying to have a little bit of adultery or a little bit of idolatry or a little bit of witchcraft or a little bit of blasphemy or a little bit of filthy communication. I've never yet met anyone who said they control their anger who did so. Then you've also got to recognize that there is God's way to control anger. How do you do that? By any, the way to control any emotion is by putting the mind under the command of Christ and His Word. And then have the mind under the command of Christ tell the will what to do. Your soul is your mind, your will, and your emotions. Have the mind tell the will what to do. And then the will says to the emotions, you calm down. Somebody does you wrong. Somebody says something to you. Something goes haywire. Then your mind under the command, your mind will go one of two directions. Your mind will say, that person did me wrong. That was rotten what they did to me. Or your mind can say, God allowed this. That's the mind under the command of Christ. God allowed this. He could have stopped it. He wants me to learn from this. There's no need for me to get upset. If I get upset, I fail the test. And so the mind says to the will, sell your emotions down, and your mind accepts biblical truth and settles your emotions down. So you deal properly with your own anger. Number three. Understand. Number one was understand there are probably things you don't understand. Number two, deal properly with your own anger. Number three, deflect anger. Deflect anger. You come up to somebody who's angry, you deflect it. How? You deflect anger. And well, let me give you the verse for that first. Proverbs 29:8. Scornful men bring a city into a snare. Notice the tie-in between scorn and anger here. Scornful men bring a city into a snare. We often, when we use wrath or anger, we use scorn with it. If you notice that? We use scorn. We're upset with somebody and we scorn, we mock, we roll our eyes, we do those things. All right. Scornful men bring a city into a snare, but wise men turn away wrath. How? By a couple of ways. First of all, by answering back gently and softly instead of harshly. Here's what we tend to do. Somebody says something harsh to us, man, we turn it up. If they're at 50 decibels, we're at 60. Then they're at 70, then we're at 80. Then they're at 90, then we're at 100. Then they're at 110, then we're at 120, then they're at 100. Hello. You know what you... I said to one couple who were having problems in their home and they were arguing a lot. And I said... I was talking to one of them and I said, you know, one person can defuse that. How? I said, every time the voice in your mate goes up, your voice goes down. They're at this level and you drop your voice. And they go up higher and you drop yours lower. And you'll watch. And what almost always will happen is it defuses it. Their voice will start coming back down. My daddy really instilled this verse that teaches this into me. I heard him say it over and over and over again. Proverbs 15:1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. Now, we know that was true if it wasn't in the Bible, but wow, how true it is and how beautifully that is pictured in the Bible. Grievous words stir up anger. A soft answer turns away wrath. And that word wrath means anger in the highest degree. Kind, gentle words turn back hot anger. Anger that is a sudden eruption of emotion. Now, human nature rebels against this. We want to defend ourselves and hurt the angry person as much as they've hurt us. But the soft answer suffocates the fire of anger, making it difficult for it to burn. That's the way you need to picture. The soft answer is like covering a fire with a cloth, making it difficult for it to burn. It doesn't get the oxygen that needs. That anger to keep burning needs your anger to feed it. Proverbs 19:11 ties in here. It says, the discretion of a man deferreth his anger, And it is His glory to pass over a transgression. You know what it's saying? It's saying that there are times when people do us wrong and we ought to just overlook it. Pass over the transgression. Just let it go by. Proverbs 12:16 ties in. A prudent man covers shame. There are times people do us wrong and we all just, hey, it's all right. I love them. I'll just let it go. Now, you can't do that with everything, but the truth is we probably don't do it enough. Another thing you can do to deflect somebody's anger is give a gift to the angry person. The Bible teaches this very clearly. Proverbs 21:14 says, a gift in secret pacifies anger, and a reward in the bosom strong wrath. It pacifies strong wrath. You give a gift, it pacifies that. What could it be? It could be a wife recognizing that her husband is having a difficult time and she fixes his favorite meal instead of just getting disgusted and saying he can eat anything he wants to. My apprentice, Jared DePoppy, shared this with me this week. He was telling me that when he was 7 or 8 years of age, which would have been about 12 years ago now, they were living in an area and there were some neighbor boys lived next to them, about 11 or 12 years of age, and they were playing football. And they were overthrew the football. They're playing in their yard. They overthrew and hit the roof of the DePoppy's house. Well, once is fine. It happened again. Then it happened again. And Mrs. DePoppy went outside and talked to him and said, please don't do that anymore. They said, we're sorry, it was an accident. She said, that's fine, it's all right. Previous to that, his dad had talked to the neighbor, witnessed to him, tried to share with him Christ. The neighbor was lost. She went back in, got back in the house, football right on top of the house again. And she went right back out, she looked at those boys and she said, if it happens again, I'm going to take that football away. She went back in the house. She wasn't in there hardly any time. And the football was on the roof again. And as it fell off the roof, she got the football. And she kept it. About 10 minutes later, those boys' mother came knocking on her door. Angry. What are you doing taking my boy's football? Just because they hit your house with it once or twice. Good night. You claim to be such a good Christian. And Mr. Poppy looked back and said, well, he shouldn't have just kept on with it. I tried to talk to him and a wall there. Lady went back. Mr. Poppy still had the football. A couple of days later, Mrs. DePoppy realized she was wrong. She shouldn't have kept the football. She knew that that lady had a certain collectible that she collected. The little things that ladies put on the knick-knack shelves and things like that. And she got to thinking to herself, if I buy her one of those, it'll sit on the shelf and be a reminder to her that I love her and that I'm sorry I offended her. She went out and bought one of those collectible items and wrapped it up as a gift, brought it to the neighbor's door, knocked on the door, and the lady came to the door with a scowl on her face. And Mrs. DePoppy said, ma'am, I was wrong. I should not have kept the football. And I've come to ask you to forgive me. Would you please forgive me? And here's the football, and wrapped up, here's a little gift. And just like that, the neighbor's tone changed. And Jared told me, he said, there was an incredible, definite change took place in that family. They became really nice to us, nicer than they'd ever been before. The dad in the family had been a really angry man. He started being nice to us. They started giving us popsicles. We were invited over to their house. Proverbs 21:14, a gift in secret pacifies anger. Number four. You want to help a person with his anger, you must not. Do not deliver an angry person from the consequences of his anger. There are inevitably consequences, and what typically happens in a home setting when a person has a problem with anger is the family covers up, or the people on the job, they cover up for this person over and over and over again. They protect them. Proverbs 19:19. Is very clear. A man of great wrath shall suffer punishment. You have to let it happen. You can't stop it. Why? For if thou deliver him, yet thou must do it again. You'll deliver this person with anger. You'll deliver him or her over and over and over again. Here's a person who beats his wife. He needs to go to jail. He should not be bailed out. He needs to face the punishment. Here's a young person who gets mad at school and vandalizes the school, and the parents go down and cover up for the child. No, the parents should not bail the child out. Whatever the punishment is, that angry child should have to face it, because that child who vandalizes the school will one of these days get angry and beat his wife. Do not deliver an angry person from the consequences of his anger. Number five, you want to help a person with his anger? Use emotional word pictures. This is a powerful thought that I've covered more thoroughly in other messages, but I think about how Nathan the prophet, when he needed to confront David about David's sin in how he had committed adultery with Bathsheba and then covered it up by having Uriah, her husband, put to death, and he needed to communicate with him. Nathan the prophet needed to communicate with him, but David is a king. How is he going to communicate with him? And he went in and told him the story of the little lamb, the rich man who had all these flocks and herds, and he had company come, and he went to the poor man's house who had a little lamb, and the little lamb was like a pet in the house, ate at their table, slept in the house with them, and he took that little lamb and killed that little lamb and fed it to his company. And David said, whoever he is, you let me know who he is. He will restore fourfold. And Nathan the prophet looked at him and said, David, thou art the man. Now, why did that work? Why did that work? Because he found an area of David's interest. He found an area where David was very tender to be touched. David had been, he had been a shepherd in his youth. He knew what it was to have a little pet lamb. He knew what it was to care for sheep and lambs. And when he gave that emotional word picture, something clicked. So you have to find an area that is an area of interest for this person, an area that this person can feel inside, and give them an emotional word picture. A mother taught her son a lesson about anger. She took a clear plastic mug, filled it with water, and set the microwave on high for 3 minutes. She and her son stood there and watched the calm surface of the water be transformed into raging bubbles, and stood there and talked to him about handling his own frustrations. Talked to him about what made him boil over inside at times. Then they talked about how he could just push the pause button and talk to her when things began frustrating him that he didn't. You know what she's teaching him? She's teaching him what the Bible talks about when it says be slow to anger. Because if you're slow to anger, you don't have to get angry at all. Then she could help him with his frustration in the early stages instead of hearing about it when he was already boiling over with his emotions. I have a friend who's the director of a large Christian ministry in the United States. And there was a fellow with the spiritual gift of prophecy, wrote an article attacking this man and his ministry. And the attack was this: there must be something wrong with this ministry because it's so big. That was basically what it was. And this man answered, this director of the Christian ministry answered this man back, wrote him or called him and said, sir, I know your spiritual gift is prophecy, and we prophets, man, we see things in black and white and right and wrong, and that's the way it is, and pull, you know. And he said, I thank God for the prophets. England ran all of hers off, and the church in England has died. But can I share with you what I felt like with that attack? I felt like you had a submachine gun that you turned loose on everybody, and when you were done, you walked over and checked the bodies and found a friend laying there. And then you just said, oh, well, he shouldn't have been hanging around so close to these enemies around here. You see what he did? He drew an emotional word picture for that man. Number six, you want to help somebody with a problem with anger? Seek and pray for the skill of patience. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 11 says, flee these things and follow after. And it gives a list of several things, one of which is patience. flee these things that are wrong and follow after, chase after patience. There is a skill to be learned about patience, like there is a skill to be learned about driving or flying or shooting or building or cooking. If somebody's going to drive, they have to learn to do it. If somebody's going to fly, they have to learn how to fly the airplane. If you're going to shoot accurately, I can't do that. My son-in-law is an expert shot and has won awards for marksmanship, but man, I'm not much of a shot at all. I've had deer right there in front of me and just shot and shot and shot, and that deer just walked right on right in front of me. But there's a skill to be learned in that. There's a skill to be learned if you're going to build. There's a skill to be learned if you're going to cook. You don't want me learning the skill of cooking on you. I assure you of that. And there is a skill to be learned with patience. You must follow after it. You must say, I want it. You must say, I'm going to chase after this. I need this. How many of you here this morning would admit you need patience? Hello? Hello? All right? I know I do. And the Bible says the truth is that we all do. Now, there's a skill to be learned with this, and you need to learn that skill. You need to ask God to give it to you. There is such a that you say, well, if I ask God to give it to me, He's going to give me tribulation. Not always. Often He does give you patience by giving you tribulation. But sometimes the Bible teaches you can just pray for patience and you can get it. But the truth is, whatever we have to get it, we need it. I've seen it take years for a husband or wife to help his or her mate conquer anger, but I have seen it happen. I have seen a wife help her husband conquer anger. I have seen a husband help his wife conquer anger. I've seen it. It's too close to home for me to tell the stories, but I've seen it. But impatient people get tired of waiting, and it's one of the biggest causes of divorce in our day. And what is the number one thing that is filed in Illinois and other states in relation to divorce? What is the grounds for divorce? Mental cruelty. What is that? It's saying, I'm not patient enough with his anger anymore. I've had it. And you know, they say cruel things sometimes. Let me tell you something. Listen, when you hear somebody make this statement, don't believe it. It is a lie. I've never heard of a single occasion where it was not a lie. Well, I never did love her anyway. I never did love you, and I don't love you now, and so I'm divorced. That's an outright lie. That is simply angry words. That is simply that person being cruel, and his heart right now feels nothing for this person, but the emotion of love comes and goes just like the emotion of anger does. There was a time when that fellow stood at a marriage altar and he was absolutely head over heels crazy about that person. How do you help a person with his anger? Number one, understand there are probably things you don't understand. Number two, deal properly with your own anger by acknowledging that it is sin and controlling that anger God's way. Number three, deflect anger by answering back gently and also perhaps by giving a gift to the angry person. Number four, do not deliver an angry person from the consequences of his anger. Number five, use emotional word pictures. Number six, seek and pray for the skill of patience. And probably the key point in the whole message, number seven, use a spiritual weapon to defeat the carnal weapon of anger. Use a spiritual weapon to defeat the carnal weapon of anger. Carnal weapons are powerful, but are not as powerful as spiritual weapons. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 3, listen. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. Notice it says we are warring. All of us are continually. The question is not whether we are warring. The question is when we are, and that we have the wisdom to use the right weapons. See, it says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. Notice he says weapons. Notice the word weapons. We've got to use the right weapons. Our weapons are mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. That's the carnal strongholds that Satan has taken in somebody's life. Spiritual weapons pull those down. Now, weapons are simply tools that are used in battle. Tools used to win battles. Different weapons have been used at different times in history. We were in Paris just a little over a year ago, Paris, France. And we went to a museum that was connected with a huge, they called it a church. It wasn't really a church, but it looked like a massive cathedral of sorts. And inside was the tomb and the sarcophagus of Napoleon. And then attached to that, a massive, elaborate thing. And it was interesting how Napoleon left instructions for this thing. It was down below. You walked into this elaborate, marble-filled, cathedral-like place, and you walked over and you had to look down to see his casket. And Napoleon designed that because they said he wanted people to have to bow their head to look at his casket. That's pride. I looked over and then I found that out, and then I walked down and I looked straight. But connected with that massive cathedral was a massive museum. And they had all kinds of ancient armor and weaponry of every sort you can imagine. It was just incredible just looking at all the weaponry that went back for literally. I mean, this was an ancient museum, and this went back for hundreds and thousands of years of history. Most of those weapons are outdated, basically obsolete. But listen to me. Carnal weapons have been the same throughout history. Cain murdered his brother because of the carnal weapon of hate. Murdered his brother Abel. Now, carnal weapons have been the same throughout history. Spiritual weapons have never changed and will never change. There are carnal weapons that are used regularly by people that are as much a weapon as a stick may be a weapon, or a sword may be a weapon, or a knife may be a weapon, or even a gun. Did you ever hear the phrase, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me"? That is not true. Angry words are weapons. Angry words can cut and burn and pierce and bruise and wound and lacerate and leave scars for life. Anger is a weapon. Jealousy is a weapon. Hatred is a weapon. Slander is a weapon. Nagging or a contentious spirit is a weapon. Unforgiveness is a weapon that we use. It ultimately destroys us. Most all these things do. But it's a weapon. Arrogant pride is a weapon. Vengeance or spite is a weapon. Did you know that you and I are born knowing how to use wrong carnal weapons? That's not a skill you have to learn. It is a skill that some people develop to a fine art. But you're born knowing how to use it. Psalm 51:5, "Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." He was saying that he was born with a sin nature. We've had 2- and 3-year-olds in the nursery who get mad and bite each other. Who taught them to do that? Where and when did any parents take them to attend a class on biting 101? Hello? No. They're born knowing how, aren't they? Children are born. You and I were born knowing how to use carnal weapons. I had some parents this week tell me about a 6-year-old who was hitting and kicking and fighting and saying harsh things, and they had to go talk to the principal about the situation. That child was born with that nature. Sometimes civilization and culture helps in a situation like that. But primarily, a person needs to be born again, let Christ move inside, and then yield to the power of the Holy Spirit, learn the truths of the Word of God, and get rid of using that carnal weaponry and start using spiritual weaponry. Now, let me show you something else. Carnal weapons are deceitful because sometimes they seem to work. There's something very deceitful about using any of those carnal weapons. Because you can use it, and it will work. You use anger, jealousy, hatred, slander, nagging, unforgiveness, arrogant pride, vengeance, and other things. Those things will work. I've had people say to me, well, I know my anger isn't right, but it's the only thing that works to bring my kids or maybe my employees into line. See, it works. I heard about a pastor of a church in the 1970s where a man in the community stole all the batteries out of all the church buses. The pastor found out, went out to the man's house. He didn't knock. He didn't ring the doorbell. He kicked the door down. And the wife asked him what he wanted. He said, I want to see Mr. So-and-so. And she said, my husband is not here. And the pastor said, tell him those batteries better be back by tonight or I'll be back after him. You know what? The batteries were back that night. Anger works. The problem is it's deceitful because when it does work, it doesn't produce the peaceable fruit of righteousness. This is the problem with... I've got an article here about this Clayton Wagner, who escaped from the Clinton jail over here, who was trying to attack and bomb abortion clinics, and we've all heard these stories about the abortion clinics being bombed. Can I tell you something? Now, first of all, that's wrong. It's wicked. It's sin. It's a carnal weapon. Sometimes it stops some abortions. It is still wrong. And I'm glad to say to you that spiritual weapons are more powerful than carnal weapons. I was asked one day, is there any way for a son or a daughter in a home to help a father with a problem with anger? And my answer was this. That son must consistently demonstrate humility and meekness. Because the opposite of anger is meekness. And if this son is continually, and anger is often rooted in pride, if this son is continually demonstrating humility and meekness, then that is more powerful than anger. Love and kindness conquers hatred, jealousy, and selfishness. My mother-in-law went to heaven now just a year and a half ago. Wonderful, godly lady. And it was said at her funeral, and it was very true. If somebody didn't like her, her means of dealing with them was to kill them with kindness. She would find out whatever she could find out to do that would... She'd bake their favorite things. She would fix them something. She'd buy them a gift. She'd kill them with kindness. What are we saying? We're talking about how spiritual weapons are more powerful than carnal weapons. Mary Haviland, awakened one evening to hear noises in the downstairs of her house, slipped down the stairs quietly to see a burglar stealing some of her valuable possessions. As she walked toward him, he noticed her presence and turned, pointing a gun at her. She looked at him and she said, "Put that thing away. I am not trying to stop you. I've come to help you. If you're so desperate as to break into people's houses and steal their possessions in the middle of the night, you must need this stuff more than I do." She then proceeded to show the burglar where the more valuable possessions were hidden. She returned to her bedroom and waited till it was obvious that the burglar had left. She went back downstairs. This would make a good story for me to just wait and tell you the rest of it some other time, wouldn't it? She went back downstairs to find a note on top of all her possessions that said, "Ma'am, all my life I have known nothing but conflict, anger, and attack, and I can deal with them. I was powerless before your kindness." Kindness conquers. Purity of heart and soul and mind and body defeats impurity. I've seen people, I've seen a husband or wife where especially a husband would have a problem with impure thoughts or impure actions or impure magazines or movies, and the wife just joins in. That doesn't help anything. Her proper purity, while not acting like she's better than somebody else and while not being a rebellious type wife, her proper purity is a powerful weapon against his impurity. Gentleness is a weapon against harshness. Forgiveness is a weapon against unforgiveness. One of the reasons that I greatly admire and respect President Abraham Lincoln is because there have been few men in history who were so wise in the use of spiritual rather than carnal weapons. An opponent of Abraham Lincoln attacked the great president, calling him a fool. Someone told Mr. Lincoln the accusation and asked his response, and he replied, "Well, he must be right, for he is a very wise man." How would Lincoln's opponent ever answer that, tell me? Spiritual weapons are more powerful than carnal weapons. I said to an individual this week, I said, humility almost always conquers pride. Humility is a powerful tool, a powerful spiritual weapon. And pride is a carnal weapon. One of the most outstanding books I've ever read on Lincoln is a book entitled Lincoln on Leadership. It's by Donald Phillips. And he has a chapter in there. Chapter 5 is Never Act Out of Vengeance or Spite. He quotes Abraham Lincoln in 1862 where Lincoln said, "I shall do nothing in malice." That's in the middle of the Civil War. "What I deal with is too vast for malicious dealing." And then Donald Phillips, the author, writes this: "Whenever Lincoln had doubts, and there must have been many, he fell back on the foundation of his personality: honesty, integrity, compassion, and mercy. He seemed to have virtually no feelings of hate, vindictiveness, or malice. Many people of his day thought his tendency toward leniency was overdone. Did you know that President Abraham Lincoln granted more pardons than any president in the history of the United States before or since? He kept warrants for execution marked cowardice in the face of the enemy, pigeonholed in the desk in his office, and referred to him as his leg cases, running itch, or vulnerable heels. He said once, 'I leave it for you to decide. If Almighty God gives a man a cowardly pair of legs, how can he help the running away with him?'" With this philosophy in hand, Lincoln would scrawl on the back of an envelope containing a request for clemency a simple, "Let it be done." In one case, he saved a 16-year-old boy from the firing squad by telegraphing General George Meade that he was, quote, "unwilling for any boy under 18 to be shot." And one of my favorite stories of the life of Lincoln is where his two sons, Willie and Tad, aware of their father's frequent pardons, sentenced their soldier doll to death as punishment for sleeping on guard duty, and then went to their father, and this, you can read this yourself, this is in writing, this is still in existence. They asked their father if he was going to pardon him, and President Lincoln wrote, "The doll Jack is pardoned by order of the president. He commanded on executive mansion stationery and signed it just as he did all of his pardons, A. Lincoln." He was a man who knew the wise use of spiritual weapons. By the later stage, listen to this, by the later stages of the Civil War, now you remember that the Civil War ended in April of 1865. In February of 65, he left Washington to conduct the Hampton Roads Peace Conference, where he met with several Confederate leaders. During that meeting, the conversation eventually got around to their fate. Lincoln stated unequivocally that they had forfeited all right to immunity from punishment. After a long pause, one of the Southerners addressed the president. "Then, Mr. President, if we understand you correctly, you think that we of the Confederacy have committed treason, that we're traitors to your government, that we have forfeited our rights and are proper subjects for the hangman. Is that not about what your words imply?" "Yes, you've stated the proposition better than I did. That's about the size of it," Lincoln replied. Then there was another long pause, and the commissioner said, "Well, Mr. Lincoln, we've about concluded we shall not be hanged as long as you are president if we behave ourselves." They understood his compassionate nature. They understood his forgiveness. In his second inaugural address, literally hours before he would be taken by an assassin's bullet, some have called it his Sermon on the Mount, he gave in eloquent terms the depth of his conviction when he said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on." Listen to these powerful words. strive on to finish the work that we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan. Notice he didn't say which side, north or south. He said just care for him who has borne the battle, for his widow and his orphan, to do all we which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Another biographer of Lincoln told about Susan Sloat, told of General Lee's surrender to General Grant, April 9th, 1865. I'd never heard this until I read this in biography. I don't know how I'd missed it. Notice the influence of the spirit of Lincoln himself in the surrender of that took place. After writing out a simple document, listing the concessions expected of the South, the Confederate soldiers were to leave their armies and go home. They would not be disturbed by the United States government if they kept their word not to fight again. Enlisted men would turn in their weapons, though officers would be permitted to keep theirs. General Lee nodded as he read over the terms. They were generous. As he laid the document down on the table, he made a request. Would General Grant allow the members of the Confederate Army to keep their horses? Lee explained that many of the animals would be used in spring plowing. They would be sorely missed if confiscated, and the enlisted men were too poor to buy new ones. Grant agreed that the men could keep their horses, and then said that those without horses would be permitted to take one each from the Union Army's store for their journey to go home. What is that? That's killing them with kindness. Lee read the revised terms with satisfaction. He said, this will have the best possible effect on the men. He signed his name. Then Lee remarked, General Lee, a great man, both these were great men, that his men had had nothing to eat in recent days besides parched corn. General Grant snapped an order to his aides. Any Union soldier who has three rations is to hand two of them over to the Southern soldiers. And Lee thanked him, and the two generals departed in opposite directions. I began by telling a story about a classroom where a professor had said, draw a picture of somebody you hate. Here's the darts you can throw. And people drawing these pictures, putting them up there, and these darts are ripping this target into little pieces. They finally got done. And the professor walked over and began removing the target from the wall. And underneath the target was a picture of Jesus. A complete hush fell over the room as each student viewed the mangled picture of Jesus. Holes and jagged marks covered his face and his eyes were punched out. And then the teacher said these words, Matthew 25:40. Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you've done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. They thought their anger was really at that person. The truth is, when we don't deal properly with anger, our anger is not just at our wife, our husband, our children, our friends, the people we work with. When we don't deal with our anger is at those all around us. And it really ought to begin today with somebody trusting Christ as Savior, repenting of sin, receiving Jesus, and with many in the altar saying, God, help me to deal with my anger. And many in the altar saying, God, help me to help those around me with their anger as well. Would you bow with me, please?